Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this special meeting of the Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency Board of Directors for September 30, 2022. And with that, I would like to call the meeting to order and ask Director RJ Kelly if he would kindly lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Go through a brief set of announcements. This meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Treatment Plant Boardroom as a convenience to the public. Members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the board using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. The tour itself will not be accessible through Zoom. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or the internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raise hand feature in Zoom and you will be notified when it is your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial *9 to raise your hand. When it is your turn to speak, dial *6 to unmute. We do have members of the public present, and I do have a comment card, but for those who haven't, you don't know, there's public comment cards out in the hallway on the table. Please fill one out to help facilitate public comments. The logistics for today's meetings are as follows. We will take public comment under item 3 for items not covered in the agenda. Staff will give a presentation on the upcoming tour. Public comment will then be heard on the presentation or anything related to the tour. Once the presentation has ended, for those taking the van, please see the board secretary who will direct you to the appropriate van. And for those following in their cars, please go to your cars and follow the vans to each facility. The tour portion of this meeting is an in-person meeting only. There is no Zoom access. Please fill up your water bottles before you leave the building. Stop at the restroom. We will have one restroom stop at the Rockefeller midpoint of the tour. Any staff participating in the tour, please grab a snack bag on your way out. And board members, please take your snack bags that are at your spots. Once the tour has ended and we arrive back at the agency, please return to the boardroom for adjournment. All directors are present today, with the exception of directors Ford and Gutzeit, and so far, Director Bronstein. With that, we will continue with the agenda and go to item 3, public comments. I do have a public comment card from Director Bronstein has just joined us, so we are in full attendance with the exception of Directors Ford and Gutzeit. We do have a public comment card from Cam Noltemeyer. Ms. Noltemeyer, would you like to come to the podium and make your comment?
Cam Noltemeyer, I just wanted to bring to your attention something that is going to be happening on November 8th, and that the very first time we are going to have an election of board members. I am looking forward to that, and I wanted to make you aware of it. It's November 8th, elections, and at that time, we bring the board down to, I believe it's 9 members. This is the first for this community, and I think it's past due. And I'm looking forward to that. And I just wanted you to be made aware of that. And and prepared for that situation. We do not intend to go on the ride around today. We will listen to the verbiage as you present it now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Noltemeyer. Before we continue with public comment, I want to make one change to what I announced earlier. Director Planbeck is not here yet. Hopefully she will join us, but at the moment she is not with us.
Gary.
Director Colley.
Could we just once again correct the record so that anybody listening would know that we have in fact had previous elections, and actually everyone is sitting here, or most of us sitting here, have been elected to office, and it's simply not true that this is the first ever.
You are correct.
Just think we ought to, when there's information put out there that's simply not true, I think it's better for we correct it.
Feels kind of like Groundhog Day when that comment comes up.
Agree. Thanks.
So, yes, we have had an election in 2020, as you can see. With that, we don't have any other public comment cards. Do we have any member of the public that want to comment online, April?
There is not.
Very good. Thank you. We move to item 4, approval of the agenda. Are there any changes, additions, or modifications to the agenda from the board? Seeing none, the agenda is hereby approved, and we can move to item 5, which is treatment, distribution, operations, and maintenance section pre-tour presentation presented by Director of Operations and Maintenance, Mr. Mike Alford. Mr. Alford, proceed, please.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to see everybody's smiling face on this early Friday morning. Would you all indulge me for about 45 seconds? And this would include everybody in attendance. We're going to do two rounds of 4, 7, 8. We're going to breathe in for 4 seconds. We're going to hold for 7. And we're going to breathe out for 8 seconds. Okay? Ready? You can close your eyes or stare at inanimate object or something. Okay. Ready? In 2, 3, 4. Hold 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Out 8, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. In 2, 3, 4. Hold 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Out 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Thank you very much. Now, hopefully, that has calmed your sympathetic nervous system and activated your parasympathetic nervous system. Because this is going to be a long day. So this is TDOMS, Treatment, Distribution, Operations, and Maintenance section. We make up more than half the agency's staff. And so we're going to get into this. This is for informational only. Of course, we'll entertain some questions, but it's really to give you an in-depth perspective on what happens to get and how we get water from the source to the customer, right? Yes, there's a ton of other stuff in the background, accounting, finance, water resources, and all that. This is sort of the nuts and bolts of how we get that water from source to tap. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you, April. Okay, so this is our service area boundary. The colors represent our separate public water system codes, right? So when we merged, we each had separate water system codes with Division of Drinking Water. We still, to this day, have those codes. Hopefully, in the not-so-distant future, we will have one code, and then those colors will go away. They'll actually turn into different colors. They'll turn into zone boundaries, and there'll be a lot more colors on it. There is one color there, actually two. There's the brown one, which I think is Wayside on a ranch, and then the dark blue, which is LA District 36. So we still have a wholesale customer, but it's a very small component of our operations. Next slide, please. So this is a little more in-depth look at that. And, you know, we've been trying. When we merged in 2018, there was a lot of stuff we had to get done. The first being mixing cultures, which was quite difficult, and it's still ongoing. But as Matt Stone likes to say, we've almost hit critical mass in terms of we have so many new people that don't have that legacy baggage, right? I have legacy baggage. Steve has legacy baggage. Matt has just a little bit of it because he was sort of, you know, he came in a little bit later on. Keith, you know, all of us that have been here throughout the years from different agencies, a lot of you have legacy baggage. No offense, of course. But it does prevent you from really looking at this as SCV water. And so our PWS codes are legacy baggage. And we still tend to refer to things as the Castaic system, the Santa Clarita system, the Valencia system, the Newhall system. But it's really the SCV water system with our separate PWS codes. And that's what we've been trying to enforce I don't know what the word I'm looking for, but just, you know, keep it in everybody's mind that that's what we are. We're SCV water. Next slide, please. So facilities by the numbers. We have two surface water treatment plants, Earl Schmidt Filtration Plant and Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant, which I think I'm going to rename because I'm not sure why we call it filtration plant and why we call it water treatment plant. They're both water treatment plants. So, but that's, you know, a side thing. It's kind of my own pet peeves. We have 107 storage structures. We have earth embankment ones, underground storage that are concrete. We have above ground concrete. We have steel, but they're all storage structures and they all store water. The asterisk is pointing out that we currently have one recycled water tank inactive. That is active. We have 93 pumping stations, and I'll get into a little bit of details of all of these. 58 wells, 332 hydraulic control valves. Now, I wouldn't normally include hydraulic control valves in a presentation of facilities, but they are very important in the aspect of we have what we call subzones. So if there's an area where pressure is too high, we have these pressure control valves that reduce the pressure. So it's based on elevation, and you have to draw the line somewhere when you are building homes and things. And someone's going to be at the top of the zone, someone's going to be at the bottom of the zone. And you just want to make sure that everybody has at least acceptable pressure. And so that's where some of these hydraulic control valves come into play. And there's other ones as well at pump stations and things. We have 928 approximately miles of pipeline. So let's think about that for a second. If the average pipe lasts 100 years, okay, that's pretty good. I mean, some last longer, some definitely last shorter. But if the average pipe lasts 100 years, that means we should be replacing, on average, 9.28 miles of pipeline a year. We are not doing that. I think LADWP is like 300 years. How long it would take them to replace all their pipes. So, you know, do we have to replace every single piece of pipe, 9 miles every year? No, we don't. But we do need to think about targeting really key areas for pipeline replacement so that we don't end up with really old infrastructure that is not adequate and efficient. We have approximately 74,534 service connections. That number definitely changes. That number includes, fire services. It also includes, I think, construction meters in the total count. So a lot of these numbers we have to report to the Health Department, Division of Drinking Water, every year. And, you know, if someone is inactive, someone moves out of their house, that's no longer an active service connection. So if there's a vacant home right now, that's not active, but roughly that's the number. And I just wanted to throw all these numbers up there to give you sort of a real broad perspective of the agency. And there's many more. We have, I think, close to 25,000 distribution system valves, which I think is also a later slide. So I'll stop there. Next slide, please. So we'll start with surface water treatment. And I'm not going to get too into detail because in the not so distant future, we will do a conduct a surface water treatment plant tour. It'll be at the end of or during one of the evening board meetings. I think we've done that in the past, but I know the new board members have not seen that. So, and I should be addressing the pictures as well, and I will from here on out. We have two intake pump stations. So those intake pump stations take the water from Castaic Lake and bring them to the respective treatment plant, right? So we have an intake pump station for Earl Schmidt, and we have an intake pump station for Rio Vista. In total, there's 13 pumps at both intake pump stations with a capacity of around 167 million gallons a day. The treatment plant capacities, the two of them, is around 122 million gallons a day. So some of you might look at that and say, well, why do we have more capacity on the intake pump stations and less capacity at the treatment plants? Does anybody want to take a guess? Look at that. Must be an operations person. Yeah, so we have to have backup equipment in case something fails, right? So if a pump blows up, a motor burns out or something, we need to be able to supply whatever the treatment plant needs to treat. And so you have that redundancy. And you can see, and you'll see throughout these pictures that the colors are different on the motors. Like, so the bottom one, that's a newer pump station, you know, more recently. I think that's the expansion that was done at Earl Schmidt. And the top one is the Rio Vista. Now, does it matter that they're different color? No, not from the operation of it. But we'll get into some of that a little bit later. The top picture is the Rio Vista clear wells. And I think the bottom one is the Earl Schmidt. Next slide, please. So we're going to get into a lot of the detail about this stuff. We use 8 different types of treatment chemicals at our 2 treatment plants. Chlorine gas, only used here at Rio Vista. Sodium hypochlorite is used at Earl Schmidt, and that's used for disinfection. Oxygen, we have liquid oxygen because we have ozonation, which is a pre-disinfection aspect of drinking water treatment, surface water treatment. Aqueous ammonia, which is mixed with the chlorine, so we make chloramines for our disinfectant residual. Caustic soda, ferric chloride, cationic polymers, non-ionic polymers. So these are the treatment chemicals to help remove the turbidity, which we've heard about just I think it was last week or maybe the week before, to help treat the water. And these chemicals require certain maintenance, right? The structures, you can see the pictures. The bottom one are chlorine gas cylinders. We've actually increased our chlorine gas storage, the amount that we have on hand. And that was primarily due to the issues that came up last year, I think it was, where we received notice that the supply just wasn't coming in. Jones had issued one of the chemical manufacturers, what's that term called? A force majeure letter to us. And so we've increased it. We had the capacity, the room. And the intent was to bring in additional chlorine gas supply as the treatment plant expanded, but we figured let's get it in now so we have backup. And then just a few short weeks ago, we had potentially an issue if the rail folks went on strike. There could have been an issue impacting delivery of chlorine gas. So we're in good position. So to get these chemicals into the water supply, you have to have pumps. And so we have 35 chemical metering pumps, which also require maintenance and operations. Next slide. So a little more detail on the process, and Rafael Polito, who's our treatment plant manager, he'll give you a better explanation on surface water drinking water treatment than I can. But we do a pre-disinfection, which is with ozone. And what that helps with is it reduces the disinfection byproducts, haloacetic acids and trihalomethanes. Because if you add chlorine in the initial process with total organic carbon, then you start creating those disinfection byproducts. Ozone doesn't do that. But you don't use ozone at the tail end of the treatment because it doesn't leave a residual in the distribution system. Then we go through coagulation rapid mixing. So our treatment plants are classified as alternative treatment because we have something called upflow clarifiers. We don't have the traditional or conventional type of treatment where you go through sedimentation basins and all that. It's the same process. It's just a different technology. And I think there's, yeah, you can't really see it, but the upper right picture shows there's a sticker that says rapid mixing. So there's pumps there, and that's where the chemical gets injected, and then the rapid mixing happens. We have 22 clarifiers, 10 at Schmidt and 12 at Rio Vista. And same, we have 22 filters, 10 at Schmidt and 12 at Rio Vista. We have four clear wells. So a clear well is the storage. So that goes into the storage that I said we had storage structures after treatment. So we treat it and then we put it in the storage so we have that ability to serve the distribution system. And then you can see the lower right picture is one of the clear wells, which has a floating cover. So that rises and lowers. And then we have the disinfection process. And then it's not at the end, but it's part of the treatment process is the sludge wash water return. And that's the middle picture on the right. So filters need to be backwashed as well as clarifiers from time to time because they get buildup, right? You know, if you're filtering something, it's capturing something. And so the efficiency of those filters starts degrading. And so then you need to backwash it and you send it to that wash water return basin. The sediment sludge settles out. It's non-hazardous. It's just the turbidity that we've removed. And then that goes into drying beds. And then the water comes back into the inlet side of the treatment plant and is retreated again. So that water is not wasted. Next slide, please. So this is sort of just recapping the eight different types of chemicals, chlorine, ammonia, all of that. More than 60 water quality analyzers and meters within the treatment plants. And again, those need to be routinely maintained, replaced as needed, calibrated, cleaned, all of that. We measure things like chlorine dosage, ammonia, turbidity, ozone levels, pH, temperature, a whole variety of things. And then we also have more than 60 in-plant pumps. So that includes those, whatever I said, 30-something chemical injection pumps. It also includes the pumps to move the water throughout the treatment process. And all of that, again, requires maintenance and operation. Next slide. So that's one source for drinking water, right? Our surface water that comes through the State Water Project. Groundwater wells, 56 of them. We have 43 in the alluvial, 13 in the Saugus. So we have two different aquifers, and I'll talk a little bit about that more in the next slide. The total potable capacity is 62,000 gallons per minute. Now, that doesn't mean we're producing 62,000 gallons a minute at one time. It's what the permitted capacity is when you drill the well. So when you drill a well, you pump test it, and the pump test tells you how much you can efficiently produce out of that well. Produce 2,000 gallons a minute, 2,000 gallons a minute, 2,500 or whatever it is. We generally operate our wells, we like to, no more than 75 to 80% of the year. And that's because you need to maintain them. And you can't run them 24/7, 365. It's just impossible. But the total capacity is what we have the availability if it's needed. Next slide. So here's an aerial that shows as the crow flies, our most eastern well, which is on the right side of the picture, is well P1. And the most western well on the left side of your picture is E17. And it's about, I think it said, is it 13 or 18? I can't see it. 13 miles, yeah. So that kind of just gives you perspective. And you can see the Santa Clara River sort of meandering through the middle of the valley. You can see the San Francisco kind of coming down from the upper left, Castaic Creek. Those all feed into it. And most of our wells are in and around those tributaries or the main stem of the Santa Clara, because that's where the underlying aquifers are. Next slide. So this kind of depicts the difference between alluvial and Saugus. So those two long white straws, if you will, are pulling water from the deep Saugus confined aquifer. Those sort of darker, I don't know if that's pink or darker, whatever, salmon color. Those are more clay, so that's what confines it and separates it. The water's coming from those lighter ones, and you can see the arrows pointing in. And then that, I guess it's sort of brownish with a little bit of white specks with the shorter straws, that's the alluvial, the unconfined aquifer. That lies right directly under our natural waterways in the valley, Santa Clara River and the tributaries. And it's sort of tilted, if you will, right, to the west. Because where does water flow? It flows from, well, if you're across the Continental Divide, thank you very much. It flows in a certain direction, yes. See, this is interactive. It's like a classroom session. Thank you very much for that. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's some pictures of groundwater wells. Now, the one in the upper right is not an active well. It's an abandoned well, but it's an appropriate abandoned well. It's still able to be used if we need it. We just would need to pull that welded shut cover. We would need to, you know, video it. There's a bunch of things you need to do to put that back active. The one on the bottom is a well in the middle of the Santa Clara River. That's why it's on a pedestal, right? So we have wells throughout the valley, and we have different shapes and different sizes of wells. The one on the left is more of a traditional one with a chain link fence with some screen stuff to put in there to kind of block so you don't see inside it. That little tall pole that you see on the far left that goes up, extends up above, that's a SCADA antenna. So we can communicate back to the office and remotely. Next slide. Thank you. So again, this is sort of the mantra of the presentation is the information and the things that we do with the wells. So I'll read it first and then I'll kind of talk about some of those pictures. They're sampled at various times throughout the year, right? So each type of contaminant that we sample for is a different requirement in Title 22 Safe Drinking Water Act, right? So for example, volatile organic chemicals are required to be sampled at the wells annually, unless there's a detection. There's a detection, then you got to do it quarterly. So, and these are all spelled out in the regulations. We sample them monthly for bacteriological, and there's all sorts of different range of things. So again, that requires staff to go out there and collect these samples, and then a lab to analyze them, which we do much of it here, which is great. Our wells are disinfected with either chlorine, which is free chlorine in the form of tablets. I have a slide later that talks a little bit more about disinfection, or chloramines, which is a combination of chlorine and ammonia. And then we have data, we have instrumentation at these wells that also needs maintenance. You guys are going to eventually say these words for me. And operation. They include pressure, flow, volume, water levels. So we have transducers that are measuring the groundwater level, as well as we take manual measurements just to make sure the instrumentation is working. Because, you know, everybody knows that technology doesn't always work. And then also measure disinfectant residuals. So the picture in the upper right is a column of pipe that's in the ground. You can kind of see the little slots in them. And that's where the water enters into that column. And then you have pumps that lift the water out of the ground and into the system. And you can see that they look differently, our wells. The one in the middle on the bottom, it's all white. And it's a really short run. So does anybody want to take a guess as to why that may not be great to have such a short run from a pump, from a well, or any kind of pump? Metering, right? It's not fair, the operation guy here. It's measuring flow. So you're supposed to have so many feet of, or inches, depending on the size of the pipe, of straight pipe before and after the meter to accurately measure the flow of water. And you have one that has chain link fence with an elevation. You can see that one actually has a shade structure. That's something that I'm a big proponent of. Not only does it keep the equipment cool and, you know, doesn't get beat up from the sun, but if staff is working out there in the middle of summer, it provides them at least a little bit of shade. Not most of our wells don't have them, but that's something that I think is important that we do. You can see the big motor on the right. I think that's a 300 horse maybe. The one on the left, you can see in the foreground, in the top, that's one of the tablet feeders, chlorinators. So it's adding. And so you can see we have block walls. You know, do you need block walls at every single well? Probably not. But it does provide better protection from vandalism and just kids and sound. Exactly. See, look at this. Interactive. I love it. Next slide, please. They are noisy. They are. This is source water pump stations, formerly known as turnouts. Now, we only have one turnout. No, we have two. Sorry. We have two turnouts that we sell water to LA 36. the rest of the turnouts are no longer turnouts because we're not purchasing water from each other anymore. They're pump stations. They're taking water from the surface water transmission pipeline and pumping it into the distribution system. We have 14 that are pumped and we have 10 that are gravity. What that means is the gravity ones are at a low enough elevation and the clear wells, remember from the treatment plants, are at a high enough elevation to provide enough pressure into the system where you don't have to pump it. But some of them are at higher elevations and you do actually have to pump it. And, you know, one of the most expensive aspects of our operations is energy, because we live in a very beautiful but varied topographic area, right? We have hills all over the place. It's lovely. And sometimes you see the nice little tank on a hill and stuff. That's great. But you got to get water to those hills, right? You got to get water to those customers and those tanks that are in those hills, and it's expensive. So the capacity approximately is about 109,600 gallons a minute for those source water pump stations. Don't call them turnouts. Next slide. Now, this is a very messy slide, but I think it illustrates the point that we do a lot of operation and maintenance. These are the other pumping stations. So these are also called booster stations traditionally. I got to tell an interesting, a funny story. When I first started at Newhall, which was in 2010, the production guys, which are now called water systems techs, called the turnouts booster stations. And I'm, no, they're turnouts. They're like, no, they're booster stations. I said, no, they're turnouts. It's a source supply that we purchased from somebody else. It's a turnout. Well, now they're appropriately making fun of me. I thought you said they were turnouts. I'm like, well, they were turnouts, but they're not turnouts anymore. The composition of those pumping stations, the boosters, we have 7 hydro stations. So there's some areas. So this is sort of the opposite of what a pressure control valve does. We have some areas that are that don't have enough pressure, and we have no way of getting them more pressure because they're too close to the bottom level of a tank, a storage tank. So we have these hydropneumatic stations that pressurize the water and then serve it. We have 7 of those. We have 1 recycled water pump station so far. That's right across from, what is it, Jimmy Dean's and that sort of stuff on the old road. We have a sewer lift station, which is a pump station. The sewer comes in by gravity, goes into what we call wet wells, and we pump it out and pump it into a forced main, and then it continues its journey down to the treatment plants. All in all, there's 170 pumps within these pumping stations with a total capacity of about 130,000 gallons a minute. And again, they require a lot of operation and maintenance. Next slide. You can see the various looks of each. Some have shade structures, some don't. Some have block walls, some don't. Some have fences. The reason why there's no fence in that lower left one is because that's within a tank site location. So it has a broader fence around the entire facility. You can see that little one at the top left. That's just for a few homes. We call it, I think it's the SOS. Hydropneumatic station. I don't remember exactly what it stands for. But what I really want to talk about is that picture in the upper middle, the one with the 2 red, and then you see the hoses coming off of that. So what happens when there's a power outage and you can't pump from a booster station to a tank? You throw up your hands and you go home for the day. No, you don't do that. You either bring a generator out to provide power for that facility, or remember, there's a suction side of a booster station and there's a discharge side. So there's a source of water on each side. We have set up in certain key locations where you can connect pipe, potable pipe, and bring a potable, portable booster station and pump water from the suction side into the discharge side and get it up. And so it's just another way that we can provide water in the event of an emergency, power outage, things like that. Next slide. So what do we do at the source water pump stations, previously known as turnouts? We sample water from both the surface water treatment plants and the Saugus perchlorate treatment facility, treatment plant, through a transmission pipeline into the distribution system. These are maintained and sampled on a routine basis. The data collected is the same as I said before: flow, volume, disinfectant residual, pressure, all of that. And then the only 2 turnouts we have are LA36. And there's, you can see again, the difference in the look. And the look doesn't matter But it would be nice if we had a consistent color scheme, a consistent maintenance schedule, which is something we've been working on, and I'll get into a little more detail later, across the board. But it takes time. Next slide. Here's some booster stations. And again, very different. There's one on the upper left that looks like a little home, because that's right near some homes. And so you want to make sure you adequately soundproof them so it doesn't disturb the neighbors in the proximity, because these are in the distribution system, right? A lot of our wells and such are within more commercial areas. Now, some are near residential, but our booster stations are right smack dab in the middle of the community in residential areas. And so you want to make sure you adequately provide sound control for those. We pump water from lower elevations to higher. I've already said that. They're maintained. I already said that. And I already said the other thing. So let's go to the next slide. Storage structures. So remember I said we had a bunch of storage structures. This kind of lays them all out. And it kind of repeats some of the stuff I said already. We have approximately 213 million gallons of potable water storage. Now, we're including in this number the clear wells, which previously, before we merged, we didn't count that because we looked at it separately. You know, Valencia had their amount of storage and Santa Clarita had their amount of storage and New Home such. But now it's collectively. We need to look at it that way. We need to understand how much storage, how much water, if the entire valley went dark, how much water do we have that we can't treat or pump from the wells anymore? How much can we then bring into the system? Now, remember, though, these are dynamic situations. The level of the water fluctuates. So, you know, hopefully when it goes out, we're at a high level and not a low level. But we do, when we get red flag warnings, right? The high winds are coming. We're going to have potential for fires and such. Operations is on alert and we immediately start filling our tanks. We have what we call red flag levels of our storage supply. And so we raise those as quickly as we can to get them there. Now, you don't want to hold them there forever because then you're going to have poor water quality. You want to have a nice swing in your levels. But obviously, when there's a potential emergency, you want to have enough supply. And then we have currently 1.5 million gallons in recycled water storage, which hopefully sooner than later, we're going to add another, I don't know what it is, 1 million or 2 million gallons in Vista Canyon area. Next slide. See, even the audience can participate. I love it. You can see the different styles, right? We got in the upper right, we have a ladder that climbs to the top. On the lower right, we have stairs. There's actually a presentation coming to the E&O committee, I think a week from yesterday, that's going to get into something about this. You can see some areas have two tanks, some areas have more, some areas have one. The one in the middle on the top is during a recoat. You can see how nice and clean it is on the inside. But again, they all look different, and we're trying to, we have our color scheme is bayberry. We seem to like that color. It works. It kind of blends in nicely, but not all of them look like that. But as we need to recoat these, right, because they need to be recoated, over time, the coating degrades. You might have some kids that throw rocks at the tanks, and then all of a sudden you have a little chip mark, and it's going to rust, and so you have to go out there and repair that. But over time, we will all have bayberry color for all of our above ground storage tanks. Next slide. It's kind of like a olive green, so it fits in nicely. You know, we've tried over the years sand color. What's that? Kind of, yeah, very good. See, look at that. Yes, I like it. We sample them weekly for nitrification. So, you know, when you add ammonia into your drinking water system with chloramines, yeah, you do reduce the disinfection byproducts, but now you're adding a food source for bacteria. So you got to make sure you don't go into nitrification. So we do sampling for that. They're inspected and cleaned every 3 to 5 years, AWWA recommendation. They're recoated as needed, as you can see in the upper right. That was our last coal tar. So we had coal tar coated inside, not the epoxy. And coal tar is great. But you know, you want to make sure you remove that when you recoat for, with epoxy. And then the bottom right is a picture of the recoat. Hopefully Rebecca's not here, is she? Hopefully the safety aspect is all in order on that slide there. And again, we collect data. We collect water levels, tank levels, the status of altitude valves that would, you know, it's a valve that would shut off so the tank doesn't overflow. Status. We have earthquake valves at our tanks, not all of them, but most of them. We only put one earthquake valve when there's a pair of tanks. And the reason for that is if you have an earthquake and the earthquake valve closes, which is a good thing, but the pipeline associated is not damaged, you don't want to cut off supply. So if you have two tanks, one with and one out, one closes, the other one, and we don't close them 100%. I think we close them, I think it's 75%. But those need to be maintained routinely. I think annually we have them tested. We have mixers to help keep the water quality good inside these tanks. Bunch of stuff. Next slide, please. Here's our sanitary sewer system. So yes, we have sewer. We own and operate a sewer system. The upper right and the upper middle are two manholes that are in the middle of the Santa Clara River. And they have been reinforced so that during a major storm event, the likelihood of them getting washed out is minimized because of the way we have constructed those now. The picture in the lower, the kind of map graphic, you can see the dark green lines. Well, they don't connect. They do still connect, but it's our ownership. So we've been slowly getting rid of sewer. The city will take it over, but there's certain criteria that must be met. And I think Steve had talked about that at a previous board meeting. But the one on the upper right, green, and the red, that's our sewer lift station, which is the picture on the left, far left. And then the green is a forced main that goes up over a hill, and then it goes into gravity, which now the city owns and maintains. And then the green line in the far left with all the little red circles, that's the remaining portion in the river that we're seeking grant funding to help us move it from the river outside, and then the city would take that over. Next slide. So now we're going to get into the distribution facility. So the water system guys get all the above ground stuff that people see. Now there's some above ground stuff that the utility department that you see, but most of that stuff is underground or it's small enough that maybe you don't recognize. And so you can see pictures there of valves and hydrants and, you know, I'll explain it right now. We have, you see the bright yellow hydrant and then the other, it's called safety yellow. And then the other school bus yellow. So that was something else we didn't have consistent when we merged. Some people had, you know, school bus yellow, some had safety yellow. So we've gone round and round, but we've landed on safety yellow. And the reason for that is it's in fire department code and they would recommend that. They're not requiring us to do it, but they like the safety yellow. So as we maintain these, we will be changing those out. We're not going to go out and change all 7,573 hydrants tomorrow, but over time as we maintain them. So here's some more statistics. I already talked about the pipes, valves, that's in the distribution system, 25,198. Now, I don't know, with Courtney's group getting stuff installed so quickly, it might be more than that now. Blow-offs, those are at dead ends and cul-de-sacs where you want to be able to flush the water so you prevent stagnation. We're not doing a ton of that right now just because of the drought. Air and vacuum valves, which are at high points, we have 1,844 of those. And then the hydraulic control valves, again, 332. Next slide. I'll kind of pick apart each one of these individually. All right, pipelines. Everybody's familiar with pipelines. Unfortunately, we average about 1.3 leaks a day. Now, they're not all the big ones that rise to the level where I send you all a notification, but they're leaks, and it happens. We have different materials, right? Everybody had different standards prior to the merge. We now have a very clear set of standards, design standards and specifications. We are currently changing out around 2,000 to 3,000 feet of pipeline a year. So remember what I said before. If we wanted to meet that 100 year, we got to do 9 miles. We're falling short. Do I think we need to get there? No. Do I think we need to do more? Yes. But that requires additional resources. And we'll touch on that just a little bit. Next slide. valves. So you don't see the valve because it's underground, but you see these blue lids. There's a certain gentleman in the room that invented a color scheme for these lids, Keith Abercrombie. So if you see a blue lid in the distribution system, that means it's a system valve. You see a yellow lid, that's a fire hydrant valve. But I don't, are we still doing yellow lids? Yeah, we are. Fire hydrant valves. If you see a red lid, I think it's a fire service valve. So Keith invented this so that when the guys are out there, they can quickly identify which valve needs to be shut off in the event of a break. Good job, Keith. Our goal is to exercise 20% or 5,040 valves a year, right? That's a pretty, it's about every 5 years, every valve gets exercised. What does it mean, exercised? It means you pull the lid off, you make sure there's no debris inside the can, because sometimes there's debris in the can. You operate it like the gentleman in the middle there is with a valve key, or we have also equipment that hydraulically exercises them, making sure we put the appropriate signage up for safety. To make sure it works. Because if you have a mainline break and you get on a valve and it doesn't work, the water doesn't stop flowing. And so you got to go to another valve and then another valve. And what that does, not only does it waste water because you're not shutting it off quickly enough, but it impacts more customers. So if you can shut off the closest two valves on either side of the leak, the impact to customers in terms of outage is minimized. If you have to go further and further down, it's increased. So are we hitting our 20% target? No. We are only exercising about 20% of that 20% target. We're exercising about 1,000 valves a year. Why? Because we're repairing 1.3 leaks a day. So, you know, one of the things that was difficult, and I talked about it a little bit in the beginning, culture, right? So when I started asking staff, what are we not doing? People were very hesitant. They don't want to tell you, what do you mean, what are we not doing? What should we be doing that we are not doing? Because that is almost as important as what we are doing. And I want to tell everybody right now that we have a tremendous workforce on the TDOMs, in the TDOM section. and they now trust us. They trust both Keith and I that we want to hear the data. We want to hear the good news and we want to hear the bad news so that we can prepare and provide you with the appropriate information to help us get to where we think we need to be. So, you know, it took a little time for them to gain confidence in us, but I think they do now. I think they trust us. They understand that we're all working together for a common goal, right? Providing responsible water stewardship to ensure the Santa Clarita Valley has a reliable supply of high quality water at a reasonable cost. That is our mission, right? Our mission is not just to come here and exercise a valve or fix a pipe or whatever. It's to do that. Next slide, please. Hydrant maintenance. I will mention this person's name. His name is Martin Torres. He no longer works for us. He retired years ago. I think he retired before the merge. Man, he was a workhorse. The guy was amazing. And what he's showing here is pictures of what they do when they do hydrant maintenance. They take it all apart. Those little, in that picture, the third from the left or second from the right, you see the black around that. Those are gaskets. Those sometimes get corroded over time. They have to be replaced. Maybe the threads on the stems to operate the hydrant aren't working appropriately. Maybe a valve cap is missing. The paint doesn't look good. Now, is paint important on a hydrant? Yes, for a couple reasons. One, I think it provides confidence in the public that we're maintaining our system appropriately. But more importantly, is it allows the fire department to see the fire hydrant in the middle of the night, as opposed to the one on the far left that is faded over time. Next. Our goal is 20%. Are we hitting it? No. All of our metrics that we're measuring were about 20% of our 20%. But we're giving it a valiant effort. And I got to say, we have improved since we merged. We were doing even less when we first merged because there was confusion and chaos, which is operations. But we had to organize that chaos and put some order to it and show each other that we're not against each other. We're all on the same team. Next slide. Because everybody took value, which that was something that I think was really good. Everybody took value and pride of their former agency, but they were a little guarded at first. Like, well, wait, you know, we did it better. No, nobody did it better. We're going to do it the best we can now. And I think it's finally hitting home with everybody. Air and vacuum valve and blow off maintenance. There's an example. We're not doing this much because, like I said, the drought. But again, we need to go out there and flush to help move stagnant water. We take chlorine residuals when we do this. We dechlorinate. I don't think you can see the device in that picture, but you have to dechlorinate that water before it goes into the storm drain. And just to make sure they work. As I already mentioned, dead ends, and I already mentioned what air vacs do. So that's good. Next slide, please. Meters. So as you can see, we kind of are on this journey from the source all the way through the system, and then it goes to the meter. And this is where it's at the customer's property. It's at the curbside in the right of way. We have approximately 72,931 meters. The sizes range from 5/8 to 10 inch. We're slowly changing out the 5/8 as customers move out. We have three different styles, and I know you've heard a lot about the metering already because of the AMI presentations we have given in the past, but we have the manual AMR and AMI. We have changed out of our first initial 5,000 that are remaining that are manual. I think we've had 1,000 that have already been changed out because we have the contractor on board and everything. So that's going really well. You can kind of see the difference in technology, right? The upper right and the upper left, that is a before and after. We had this big boat anchor, like we like to call it, in the past. Now we have a streamlined meter that's ultrasonic, that measured us. There's no moving parts, so there's less maintenance, which is good. Less maintenance here, so we can put more maintenance on the other stuff. We're going to these composite-type meters, plastic, right? Another word for plastic. The one in the middle on the left and the one in the below on the left. Again, those are ultrasonic, lower moving. Less moving parts or no moving parts. The picture on the bottom that looks like a couple arms coming up, right? We call that a yoke. And so we don't have very many of these left, but these were installed years and years ago to bring the level of the meter from deep to a little higher, a little shallower, so it can be read easier. So when you replace a yoke, and those are made of copper, you have to do additional work to bring that service to elevation because you don't want the service sitting 18 inches below ground. You want it right below the meter lid for easier access. Next slide. Again, I already mentioned this. We have about 5,000, actually 4,000 left. About 43,000 automated meter, in which you drive in a truck and read it. And then the AMI, which sends the information back to the office. The upper right picture with the gentleman in there, he's showing the equipment of the AMI. The lower picture is the antenna that sits on top of a tank so it can communicate, and then just the infrastructure in the ground for the meter. Next slide, please. We can't forget about water quality in lab, and I think I have about 7 minutes left. We take, in 2021, we took 9,025 microbiological samples in 2021, which means total coliform, fecal, E. coli, and HPC, heterotrophic plate count, which measures the total count of bacteria. Now, we don't always sample for fecal and E. coli. It's TC is your total coliform. That's your indicator. If there's a positive there, then you test for the latter, which are pathogens. Because our goal is to disinfect the water, not sterilize or pasteurize or anything like that. Disinfect. We're targeting the pathogens. We're not targeting everything. We're targeting just the pathogens. We collected 2,068 metals, which include calcium, magnesium, iron, cadmium, all that sort of stuff, the alkaline, and transitional metals for those chemistry buffs. Anions, 3,614, which include things like chloride, sulfate, fluoride, and perchlorate is in that. The anions and the metals are what we call inorganic compounds, and we sample those routinely. And then you have your organic compounds or your volatiles, and those we did 675 of those, and TCE, PC, and THM are just some examples. And then the new contaminant, PFAS, We've already done 893 last year, and it's going to only increase as we put more treatment facilities online. So the pictures here, the one on the top right is a sample tap. The one on the bottom right is our PFAS equipment. The one on the left on the bottom is the sample at Rio Vista here that brings in a variety of water, raw water, treated water, filtration water, everything, where they take samples all the time, I mean, throughout the day. Next slide, please. Groundwater disinfection, we have several types. We have on-site generation, which creates a 0.8 solution, and we mix that with either aqueous or liquid ammonium sulfate. The liquid ammonium sulfate is what we're moving to for a couple of reasons. It's not as hazardous, and we don't have to have what's called an RMP, a risk management plan, because there's a lot of criteria that you have to follow for risk management plans. We weren't really aware of LAS until fairly recently, where we started talking with this group, Water Quality Treatment Solutions, which is a consultant, as well as a variety of other utilities are moving to this LAS. And we get that as also in a liquid form. We also have calcium hypochlorite systems where we have tablets, not too different from your pool, although these are NSF 61 certified so that you can use it in drinking water. As groundwater treatment systems are being constructed, disinfection systems are being upgraded to these on-site chloramination. And sometimes we'll use bulk. You know, it may not make sense to have the full equipment that you see. And we're going to go on the tour, so I'll stop there. I'll show you that. We'll talk about that later. Next slide. So again, there's a variety of different types. We have gas, we have liquid, we have solid. The gamut of chlorine, right? Chlorine wants to be a gas, but humans put it in form of liquid or solid, but it still wants to get out. That's why you smell it, right? When you chlorinate your pool, because it's off-gassing. It wants to be free and be a gas again. So we have to maintain our tablet chlorinators. We have to maintain our on-site generation systems, cleaning those cells annually. And then there's obviously a lot of equipment associated, pumps, injection coils, regulators, valves, all that sort of stuff needs proper care and maintenance. Next slide, please. So we're coming into the tail end, where we are and where we want to go. So we want more secure facilities for obvious reasons. Now, the one in the upper left, that will stay a chain link fence because it's on site here at Rio Vista. It's a pump station we have here. So we already have protection of the plant. So do we need a block wall around there? We probably don't even need a fence at this point. But that was a separate agencies at the time. So maybe that's why they did that. So we want to be thoughtful in this. You know, we don't want to, I use the analogy, we don't want a Cadillac, and I'm not trying to sell any cars here. We don't want a Cadillac, but we also don't want a Yugo. We want a Camry. It looks nice, it's efficient, and it lasts a long time. And that's what I think we should shoot for. And so you can see on the picture on the bottom, the ladders, maybe we want more tanks with stairs instead of ladders. Where the two, you can see that sort of platform across. That's our catwalk. So what that does is it prevents having to build stairs or ladders on both tanks. You build it on one, you have the fall protection, and you can cross over to the other because we have to do maintenance on top of tanks as well. Next slide. Proactive maintenance. We want to do more proactive preventative maintenance and system improvements, which will improve reliability, efficiency, and customer confidence. So the top three pictures are an old air vac can. Metal. Majority of us use metal back in the day. Well, what happens with metal? It rusts and it corrodes over time, so it doesn't look good. And then when we replace that can, we also flush and make sure the air vac is working. And then on the right, you can see the nice polymer, and it kind of blends in with the environment as well. Hydrants, same thing. I talked about the different colors, but this one, the far left, that's a Wharfhead, thank you. Man, I'm drawing blanks here. That's a wharfhead. So it only has one outlet and it's a smaller outlet. We want to have a full fire hydrant in these locations so we can actually let the fire department choose whether they're 4-inch connection or the 2.5-inch connection. And you can see how staff has maintained that. Next slide, please. Where we are and where we want to go, increased infrastructure replacement programs. You're all very well aware of our plastic pipe issues. That's what it looks like. And, you know, we want to avoid that. We want to avoid disruption to the customers. We want to reduce the cost of paving, because that is one of the biggest costs. And when you replace a pipe, you cut the pavement and you just replace the asphalt within that area. When you have a major blow up like this, you're replacing a lot more asphalt. So it's more cost effective to do it. Now, granted, it's expensive to replace pipe, but it's more proactive and it's better and more cost efficient to do it up front as opposed to wait for a blow up. Next slide, please. These are treatment plants. Identify and improve upon system inefficiencies, design flaws, and operational constraints. So the picture on the left and the picture on the right are the exact same upflow clarifier. Staff has realized over time what happens is when you don't have those screens that you have on the left. So that was iteration two. When you get air, when you do backwash and then filter, you're creating air, right? And so what happens is it'll burp. And some of that media lifts out and lands on the floor around these filters and clarifiers. So you want to prevent that. But you also, since these are exposed to the sun, which I think we should also have covers over these, maybe we can partner with Water Resources and Matt Dickens and get some solar panels on these so we can get shade. You have algae buildup. So that's what the guys did. They built those ones on the left and they said, oh, wow, now we're getting more algae. And that's not good. But the water is still clean going in the trough in the middle. So then they came up with, and they're in the process and they're almost done, the design on the right, which I think was tremendous. And we're doing all of this in-house. The staff up here is doing that, the water system techs. They built these screens that come up a little higher. They're easier to maintain. They prevent or they minimize the algae growth. And they also help prevent the burping and the rising of the media that comes up. Ingenious. So we want to go more towards that. And I got to hand it. I'm going to mention Courtney again. Great hire, by the way. Great hire. I'm not saying that because he's a nice guy. Courtney has operational experience. Courtney was an operator. And it's extremely important to make sure operations and engineering work together. Because, you know, if you have an engineer in the office and that's all they do, they may create something that the operations guys go, this doesn't work. And so that collaboration is really helpful. Next slide, please. And that's it. I do have one slide after this, but that is it. And let's try to keep the questions minimal, but I know there's probably a lot. And, you know, Director Atkins would probably say this was a mega maintenance moment.
Thank you, Mike, for the presentation. Excellent. I think it opened a lot of eyes as far as how much we take care of and how much we manage. So before we open it up to questions, we have any public comment? I don't have any public comment cards on this item, April, but do we have any members of the public online who might want to make a comment?
We do not.
Thank you. Then
I don't know if I'm gonna answer.
What are you pointing? Sandra. Sandra Cattell, please.
Thank you. I didn't know I would have questions. I have three questions from the presentation. I hope Mike can answer them. First of all, when you showed at the very beginning the well pipes that had slits in it to gather the water, we have such hard water. Don't those close up and become, scaled or filled with scale? The second one is the meter numbers. If we have 72,931 meters, but we have 74,534 service connections, who's not on a meter? And the last one is, how do you know which pipes to prioritize for repairs? Now, I understand the plastic ones are important, but do you go by age? Do you go by nearby breakages, or how do you determine that? Thank you.
Thank you, Sandra. Mr. Mike.
Those are fantastic questions. And fortunately, I have an answer. Yes. Well, I'm gonna go in reverse order. So I can take the pipes first. So we actually have an internal team that includes folks from engineering operations, probably even water resources, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe it's just GIS technologies. Chris Perez here now. So we look at everything. So replacement criteria includes age, material, frequency of breaks, location. But it is an art as much as it is a science, because you can target something and say, okay, we're going to replace this, and then it blows up tomorrow. Or you can target something and say you replace it, and maybe it wouldn't have blown up for 10 years from now. There's no silver bullet that determines. All you can use is the data that you have and make educated guesses. And so the material, right? So the plastic 14 inch, we know that is not good. So we're replacing that. The age, it's a certain time frame. If it's an older steel pipe, you can want to replace that too. Location, right? So we want to make sure the pipe doesn't get too old in front of the hospital, right? So we make sure that is on the replacement schedule. And maybe, you know, some of these other ones can go a little beyond 100 years, right? So all of that sort of comes into with the pipe replacement. Meters, another great question. Some of the meters, the ones that I showed in that picture, that 72,000, those are customer meters. So we have construction meters that we don't read routinely. Like, you know, we have the engineering department read it. We have fire service meters. So the meters, the reason there's a difference is those were the customer residential commercial business meters that I was talking about. And I probably should have put that in there. So thank you for bringing that to my attention. And the last one, I can go on for days about this. Hard water. If we didn't get hit with PFAS, if we didn't get hit with COVID, if, you know, we didn't have all these life challenges, I might be up here talking about pellet softening and groundwater softening. Because I think that is something that would benefit the community as a whole. It's not a health issue, but it's a very big aesthetic issue. So yes, the wells do, those screens do plug for a variety of reasons, not only from the hard water, but also from just, you know, the debris, the sand in the soil. And so those wells have to be rehabilitated periodically, 10 years, maybe less, maybe more, depending on the location of the well. And we also look at that information. And what you do when you rehabilitate is you pull all the equipment out of the ground, you take a video, you assess the pipe column, the integrity of the steel and the plugging of the screens and slots, and then you can brush it. So they have these big, huge brushes that go down and scrape it, and then you bale all that out, and that helps clean it and helps make it last a little bit longer. So, fantastic questions. Yes, thank you.
Director Cooper.
Thank you.
What do we have in the way of all of this is asset management? What do we have as an asset management? How do we keep track of all of it and what's due at what times? And which pieces are the critical ones that we have to maintain?
Wow, these are really good questions. And I actually have answers. Unfortunately, most of our asset management now is done through spreadsheets. We do have a asset management software called MainSaver that the treatment plant folks have been using for years. And it creates preventative maintenance tickets, and then corrective action we do, and we put that information in there. And so we've been meeting, operations, technology, Chris Perez and his team, and Courtney and his team in engineering services section. We've just upgraded the MainSaver software to be a mobile platform. So now instead of putting it on paper and having somebody type it back in, it's done on an iPad. We're expanding that. We just started conversations with a company called Spatial Wave. Ali Deba worked for, I think, LADWP for years. He was introduced to me by Bob DiPremio years ago, and he sits on AWWA's committee for asset management, and he's helping us design and identify the hierarchy structure, because it's really important that you start the database correctly so that you know, are you going to be tracking every single nut and bolt? No, but, you know, you're going to go down a certain level, but you need to keep it high level to a certain amount too. So we're just rolling out with that sort of stuff. Then the third component, which we'll bring in at a later date, is Rochelle and her team, because there's a financial aspect of it. So right now, as I mentioned, we're kind of doing everything on spreadsheets and, you know, meetings and such. But in the not too distant future, I'm hopeful that we will have a very robust asset management CMMS program that enables us to really drill into these types of things.
Good. What you gave us is kind of the mechanical, electrical, distribution maintenance, but there's a whole lot more maintenance that goes into the organization. Vehicle maintenance, building maintenance, asphalt maintenance, huge issues that are out there. And there's a whole lot of maintenance that needs to go on. And I can see why you say you get 20% of the 20%. It's very hard to build.
It is. So you mentioned fleet. Our new fleet supervisor, maybe he's been here almost a year now. He's been here at least a while. He introduced something to us that we're actually using now called Fleetio. And it's an online app that, you know, we do a weekly maintenance on our vehicles. They do checks, right? They check the tires. They check all the stuff. And if there's anything maintenance, they put it in that app. It gets sent to him and he's organizing that. So that is actually working now. And it's really cool. The guys have bought into it, which is really good. Yeah.
Dr. Planbeck, go ahead.
Yeah. When we were down at the Region 8 meeting, they mentioned that Burbank, City of Burbank, is behind on their pipe replacement too. So I guess it's prevalent everywhere, about as much as we are, I think. But what I wanted to ask was about the plastic meters. Are we going to have deterioration of the plastic?
That's a great question. I was really reluctant to go to those meters. But there's a lot of data and there was a lot of research that was done. There's a cool video that shows, I think, up to 300 PSI being put in there. And the integrity holds. It's really not plastic. I call them plastic because I'm more used to a traditional brass meter. But with the lead rules, in this country, especially in this state, the brass is just not holding up as much because they're having to take, I think it's like 0.25% now or something. There's a minimal amount of lead you can have in these brass meters now. So no, I don't think we're going to have the issue of long-term. So what you got to think about, most meters, customer meters, whether it's a brass meter, mechanical, multi-jet, positive displacement, they have a shelf life, you know, a useful operating life, which is roughly around 10 to 20 years. So we kind of target 15. These newer meters have batteries. And the batteries have a life, coincidentally, 10 to 20 years. So we will be replacing these meters sooner than they will actually fail from a mechanical or an operational standpoint.
It's good because I will never forget my high impact plastic ski boots falling apart at the top of the hill. Was not fun.
Yeah, but you're much more aggressive in your skiing than just water going through them, right?
Director Armitage.
I'll be quick because I know we're, I think, a little bit behind schedule. I just wanted to say thank you also for this great overview. We heard the emphasis for the need of maintenance. I heard that loud and clear, repeated many times, for the vast quantity of all the various components that we were just shown. And I just want to say thank you to all the staff who work on all these things day in and day out, night and day when necessary. So, yeah, so thank you. And then a preemptive thank you for the tour we're about to take, because I know I told you earlier, but I want to say it as well to everybody else who was involved. I know a lot of logistics went into planning for today, and so I know we all very much appreciate, yes,
yeah,
we
really
very
helpful.
Much appreciate,
I agree with that.
Yeah, everybody who put together today for us, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other, Director Kelly?
So, Mike, I think... obviously, the presentation phenomenal as usual. Love all the humor that's thrown into it. So I've decided that I'm going to start calling you the Dr. Phil of water in the future. I have a comment and a question. The comment you were talking about repairs and pipes. And I remember we had a lawsuit. We were part of a class action lawsuit many years ago regarding a manufacturer of PVC that lied and did fraudulent PSI on their pipes, and they were breaking everywhere. So it just goes back to what you're saying about it's unknown. You don't really have all the factors, but the factors are not always internal. One of my questions, just from a safety standpoint, with all the water tanks and everything and a combination of the ladders and the stairs, what type of safety do we have there from the public, from the vandalism and things of that nature?
Yeah, great question. So Chris Perez is heading up a security team with our group, and it includes it's going to include folks from different departments. And Roland, our new facility supervisor, is going to kind of head up the whole thing. But there's definitely a aspect of technology, right, for security cameras, maybe motion sensors, lights, things like that. So all of our tanks have chain link fence. All of our tanks are visited routinely. I know we hit every single tank at least once a week. Most of them we hit twice a week or more for sampling and things like that. Staff does a complete walk around to ensure that the integrity of the security systems around it are fine. I think, I don't know if all of them, but most of them probably have some sort of like barbed wire on top. They're all tall. The ladder systems have cage around it, so, and have a lock for it. So it's really difficult. If anybody were to do that, they'd have to have bolt cutters to cut the locks and then to get access to it. In terms of employee safety, it's a great question, because there's going to be a presentation to the E&O next meeting. The rules are changing. So you have to have fall restraint equipment. And so we have the harnesses that you latch on, and then when you climb up, you're supposed to stay within a certain area when you get on top. Obviously, the stairs are safer than the ladders. So hopefully that answers your questions. Yep.
Director Cooper.
EPA is looking at making PFAS a hazardous substance. Have we tested our sludge, our dried sludge, to see if there's PFAS in the sludge?
No, but we've tested the influent water, and we haven't found any PFAS in our surface water.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
And then Director Armitage, on the PFAS thing, the vials that everybody has and the little card, those are samples that Shadi Bader from Engineering Services Section got from our vendors to show you what the resin looks like. And there's some for the public too. It's out there, I think.
All right. Have any other questions from members of the board? I don't see any. So, Mike, I'll just thank you for your presentation and ask you one real simple question that we all can relate to, I think. We've all seen people out there doing the exercising of valves. How long does that take to exercise a typical valve in the street?
Yeah, it depends on size, obviously, right? Okay. The bigger valves takes longer. You can probably, if it's in a residential area and there's minimal traffic control, you can probably knock out 10, 15 a day. If it's in like a high traffic area, McBean, Magic Mountain, where there's more traffic control, maybe you're down to 5 a day, roughly. So, you know, it probably takes the actual effort to do it on a normal size 12-inch valve, 15, 20 minutes.
And you do often encounter valves that won't close?
Yeah. And we have a replacement program as well.
Okay.
Valve replacement. Yeah, I think we just had the meeting the other day. So far this fiscal year, I can't remember the number. Somewhere in the 30, I think we've replaced so far this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
I would like to add for the tour, since if there's personal vehicles going, so the first one is a dirt road that's going to take us back to Bouquet Tank. Stay as far to the right as possible and then be patient, because you have to go in and then turn around to come out. So that there's no real way to make a U-turn on that road. So you got to go into the facility and come around. That's probably the only one, but just pay attention to that and stay far enough behind the vans so that if I need to jump out or Keith needs to jump out to, you know, traffic control a little bit, you guys are aware. So thanks.
Very good. So, Madam Secretary, we are not adjourning. We're simply moving on to item 6, tour of the facilities. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so please heed the request from the board secretary earlier. Make a pit stop if you have to. And see April about which vehicle you're going to be traveling in. We'll meet out in the parking lot.